Welcome to New Books in World Affairs. This is your host, Christian Peterson. I'm currently a history professor at Ferris State University in Big Rapids, Michigan. I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Joel Migdol about his new book, Shifting Sands, the United States in the Middle East, which is published by Columbia University Press. This thought-provoking work explores the ups and downs of U.S. foreign policy toward the Middle East since the end of World War II. Migdol makes a strong case that U.S. policymakers have tended to either ignore or misunderstand the diversity and history of the Middle East when conducting foreign policy toward the region, especially when the George W. Bush administration chose to invade Iraq in 2003. Migdol also offers thought-provoking insights about the exact place of Israel in the conduct of U.S. foreign policy toward the region and how we can best understand the most transformative moments in Middle Eastern history since the end of World War II. At the same time, Migdol offers a number of insights about how U.S. policymakers can best promote peace and stability in the Middle East in the coming years. Whatever a reader makes of these arguments, he or she will benefit from reading this book. Migdol does an excellent job of reminding us that U.S. policymakers invite trouble when they ignore the history of a region or assume the universal applicability of the American experience when they conduct foreign policy. I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I enjoyed talking with Joel Migdol. Thank you. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in World Affairs. This is the host, Christian Peterson, and today we'll be talking to Joel Migdol about his new book, Shifting Sands, The United States in the Middle East. Joel Migdol, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Christian.
Joel, I wonder if you could start with start the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle, and which is a beautiful place. I'm looking into the trees and mountains right now. I have been here for over three decades. Before that, I taught at Harvard, where I was an associate professor. I actually started my career at Tel Aviv University for 3 years after receiving my PhD in political science from Harvard.
Yeah, it's stereotypical that Washington has all the rain. It's been doing it's been raining nothing but here in Michigan for the last week. It's been horrible, horrible weather. So it's I'm kind of jealous of your situation. So I was, thank you for the background. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your book, how you decided to write it, the process that, the questions you wanted to address, how you came up with writing this very interesting portrait of United States contemporary policy toward the Middle East.
This book is actually quite different from anything I've done before. Most of my things are theoretical and state-society relations and appeal mostly to political scientists, sociologists, and the like. I've done some works on the Middle East, but they haven't been at all policy-oriented. In the summer of 2009, I had just finished a series of lectures, public lectures, dealing with the Middle East, dealing with the United States. I liked the lectures, and someone came up to me at the end of one of the lectures and said, "You're making this into a book, aren't you?" And I said, I really hadn't thought of doing that at all. I was about to go off in the fall to for a sabbatical to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, and I had applied for an entirely different project. And I said to my wife, what do you think I should do here? This sounds like a book I could do. And she said, well, why don't you take the summer and start on it? And if it goes well, you'll talk to the people at the Institute. And that it did go well. And I talked to them and I said, look, I proposed one thing, but I really would like to do something else. What do you think? And they said, we don't care what you do. Just sit in your office and write whatever you like. And so it was in that year, 2009, 2010, that I got a first draft of this book.
The first draft in 2009, 2010. Okay.
Right.
And you use the term shifting sands. I think the listeners would like to know, what exactly do you mean by that when you make advance that argument, or you advance the argument in the book and you use it as a book title?
Right. So the central theme of the book is that the United States came to the Middle East starting when President Roosevelt made a visit to the Middle East at the very end of World War II to meet with the Saudi king. And the United States developed over the next few years a kind of model of how they were going to be a daily player around the world, in every region of the world, including the Middle East. And it was a sort of fixed plan. And what I argue in the book is that these regions were not always particularly conducive to the plan, a plan that may have worked in Europe, but not necessarily in the Middle East. And the Middle East was a dynamic, changing region, and using a kind of cookie-cutter model there didn't really work all the time. And the shifting sands refers to this tension between the fixed plan and the changing dynamic Middle East.
And what do you think, in your estimation, I mean, you argue this in the book, are kind of the three kind of paradigm shifts, if I can use that term, that happened in the Middle East that in many ways the American, well, in a lot of most ways, the American policymakers did not seem to fully grasp during the time period of your book?
Right. Well, first of all, I sort of, as I wrote the last draft of the book, and this was in 2012, I came to the realization that the Middle East has undergone a kind of convulsive change in who the leading powers are and what the main lines of conflict are and what the state society relations are in the area, that the Middle East has undergone a convulsive change about every 30 years, starting in 1918 when the Ottoman Empire disintegrated and the European imperialists took over, then to 1948, 30 years later, with the creation of Israel, and shortly after the birth of nationalist regimes in Egypt and elsewhere. Then 30 years later, in 1979, with the Iranian Revolution and the Egyptian-Israel Peace Accord. And finally, in 2011, the Arab Spring and all the convulsions we're going through now. And in particular, when the U.S. came on the scene, particularly from 1948 to 1979, all sorts of things were happening. Arab nationalism was growing. And then by the end of that period, beginning to fade, regimes that were decidedly anti-American were the key powers in the region: Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. And then in 1979, a whole new set of convulsions occurred. And some of the changes I refer to there include the resurgence of Shiites and their, particularly with the encouragement of the Iranian Revolution, but throughout the Middle East, the end of Arab nationalism as a force and the growth of political Islam was a second major change, and the demise of the core powers, Iraq, Syria, and Egypt in particular, as the leading powers of the region, and now peripheral powers on the periphery of the region, non-Arab, Turkey, Iran, and Israel became the major players. So those are the three major changes: the Shiite resurgence, the death of Arab nationalism, and growth of political Islam, and these new powers.
Yeah, it's very interesting the way you frame that. It's not, I haven't seen it framed that way in a lot of the works I've read, And you also make some arguments that, to be frank, some people have agreed with and some people have found a little, what's the word I'm looking for, revisionist, as far as the position of Israel in U.S. foreign policy. I was wondering if you'd like to say a little more about where Israel fits into your story in your book.
Well, Israel plays a big role, and it's quite interesting. I start off with what I think is one of the most interesting moments in American foreign policy history, which was a meeting in President Truman's office days before the State of Israel was declared, in which Truman had his wise men, his key players, plus his personal advisor, the kind of Karl Rove of the time, Clark Clifford, sitting in an office. And Clifford argued that the United States should recognize this new state of Israel that was about to be created, that it was going to be a strategic partner for the United States, that it would strengthen the United States, and all the others in the room, including George C. Marshall, the author of the Marshall Plan, and Dean Acheson, and many famous figures of the time, argued that the United States should not recognize Israel because it would weaken America's position in the Arab world. And Truman went with Clifford and recognized Israel, much to the dismay of the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense and the others who were there. But the truth is that through the 50s and the early, and through the 60s even, the United States sort of kept it an arm's length between itself and Israel, very fearful of alienating the Arab regimes. It was only in 1970, and I devote a chapter to this, that Israel became a kind of strategic partner for the United States. What I mean by strategic partner is doing things for the United States that the United States wasn't willing to do itself. And this happened in a war called Black September, a war between Jordan and the Palestine Liberation Organization, headed by Yasser Arafat, a civil war inside Jordan. And the Syrian army entered into Jordan on the side of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And the United States saw this as a move by the Soviet Union sending its client state, Syria, into a pro-American state, Jordan, and it wanted to stop that. But the United States was in the middle of the Vietnam War. Everything was happening at home regarding the Vietnam War, including Kent State and other things at the time. So the United States asked Israel to intervene against Syria to protect the pro-American Jordanian regime. Israel actually never did intervene, but it sort of massed some troops and it buzzed with its plane. It buzzed the Syrian convoys, and the Syrians withdrew from Jordan, and the Jordan government won the war. And that was seen as the beginning of a strategic relationship with Israel that lasted for about 20 years. And was, I think, a key moment for the United States in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's an interesting argument. I haven't read, or in a lot of works I've read, the authors haven't devoted that much attention to that episode. Do you have any thoughts on why that might be? You seem to, and in fact, it's very interesting to read about why other historians perhaps haven't devoted as much attention as they should to that moment.
Yeah, it was interesting to me, too. I think part of it was that the 1967 war, which happened 3 years before that Black September war, was such an earth-shaking event that historians tended to gravitate to it to try and understand the Middle East. And I don't want to minimize the impact of the 67 war. We're still seeing its effects today. But I think on this question of the United States' relationship to Israel, that 67 war was less definitive than this very minor, relatively minor, at least to outsiders, episode called Black September. Actually, in the last, I guess, maybe 3 years, I have begun to see historians actually pick up that Black September event. And so we have a number of people working on that, and I think beginning to realize its importance.
Okay, that's interesting. Kind of picking up, you know, when the Black September war ended, how would you you address the subject in your book? How would you address or judge Richard Nixon's handling of Middle Eastern affairs? And by extension, I'm obviously including Henry Kissinger in the mix. How do you evaluate Nixon's policies toward the region?
Nixon found the region itself totally perplexing. And here was a president, I think, who understood international relations probably better than any president since Franklin Roosevelt. He wants to keep away from the Middle East. He said there's no winning for the United States in the Middle East. And it's a complex area in which anything you do is bound to backfire. And so, and he was also deeply involved in Vietnam. That was where his attention on. So the Middle East was a kind of sideshow for him. He tried to establish a very strong relationship with the Shah of Iran, seeing the Shah as the potentially most important partner that U.S. could have in the Middle East and who would do the U.S.'s bidding in the Middle East. And that failed. Kissinger never recognized that. Kissinger, even in his memoirs, talked about how great a friend the Shah had been to the United States, but the Shah was not a great friend. What the Shah did was take an awful lot of money and arms from the United States, but in almost any conflict where he could have played a role in furthering U.S. interests, he withdrew. He simply didn't get involved. And so in that sense, it was a failure. Where Nixon and Kissinger succeeded, and I think quite impressively, was that they were able to break through that Gordian knot that had been discussed back in Truman's time, which is if you befriend the Israelis, you automatically alienate the Arabs. And what Kissinger was able to do was to befriend both the Israelis and the Egyptians, the most important Arab power, simultaneously, and shepherded the way for the eventual peace treaty between the two. Now, a lot of that was luck. Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, I think was probably more important here than Kissinger was, because he recognized that if he was going to achieve his aims in Egypt, he was going to need the United States to put some pressure on Israel, that his old patron, the Soviet Union, couldn't do that. But nevertheless, they did shepherd in that period of where, and I think the most productive and successful period for the United States, the 1970s, before the Iranian Revolution, when the United States had friends in Iran, Israel, Egypt, and was trying to partner with all of them and not doing a half-bad job of it.
The Shah, I've always found, is a hard person to wrap my head around. Like you said, he didn't seem to always come to help the U.S. I remember a quote I read. I think it was David Farber's book, Taking Hostage. I can't remember exactly who he was arguing with, but the Shah said something to the effect that he was asked to, lower oil prices during the oil embargo after the Yom Kippur War. And he said something to the effect that, you know, oil's going to run out someday, and Americans are just going to have to be tougher. They're going to have to learn how to live with less. And for the time being, we're going to take as much money in oil as we can get. And the U.S. Didn't really have an answer for that type of argument. And here he is supposed to be like, you know, our protector of American interests in the regions. And he's telling the American public to get tougher and deal with less. Do you think at any level when the Carter administration took office that whether it's Brzezinski or Vance or even Carter had a good understanding of, you know, of the Shah's real place in the Middle East and, you know, the unpopularity he had developed at home?
Right. I don't think that they did. You know, and throughout the book, I say that there was a kind of disconnect between the Foreign Service officers and intelligence officers who knew an awful lot about the ins and outs of the Middle East and the top policymaking bodies like the National Security Council and the president himself, who really didn't either understand or care to listen to these experts in any great detail. There's a very funny scene in Kai Bird's recent biography of the spy Robert Ames, in which he talks about Reagan being briefed by the head of the CIA, William Casey, and Casey leaves the room, and Reagan says to his aide, "You know, that guy mumbles. I didn't understand a word he said," but it didn't seem to bother very much that he didn't understand a word he said. So, no, I don't think they had a very good understanding of the Shah, and they certainly didn't understand how alienating the coup that really propelled the Shah into such a strong position in 1953 in Iran, which was supported by the United States and overthrew a democratically elected government, how deeply felt that intervention by the United States was in Iran, and how much hatred there was both for the Shah and for the United States.
Yeah, that's certainly my sense. But it's interesting with Carter, as if Israel had had different political leadership at the time, if something could have come out of the Camp David Accords as far as the Palestinian issue. Is that just wishful thinking on my part, or just, you know, history, you know, happens the way it does, and we deal with the after effects? I mean, if things had been the stars had been aligned differently, could that theoretically Carter, near the end of his presidency, set down at least some process for beginning, you know, healing the divisions in the Middle East, or was that just never in the cards?
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation on that, and you know, in that book that I just mentioned by Kai Bird, the Ames biography, I think it's called The Good Spy. Ames himself believed that they were always on the verge, and if they can just turn the right people, they could gain that kind of comprehensive peace between Palestinians and Israelis and Arabs and Israelis generally. You know, I think at certain moments, maybe right now, today in 2014, a different political leadership in Israel could make a difference. I don't think that was true in 1979. The party in power, the Likud, was not going to cede much to the Palestinians, and the Labor Party, which was the dominant opposition and had been in power for so many years, also at that time was not in a position where it was going to make the kind of moves necessary to achieve, you know, a serious resolution of the conflict.
Yeah, that's my sense as well. You don't devote a lot of attention into your book, but I'm curious if you might say a few words about Ronald Reagan's policies in the Middle East and what you sense from your research about his role. And because I asked the question, I'm interested, is he seems to be the poster boy for conservatism in many ways. If only, what would Ronald Reagan do here? What would Ronald Reagan do here? Are there any lessons we can take from his handling of the Middle East? I mean, obviously there's some lessons not to be taken, but my sense is, is there just the Iran-Contra scandal is the end of the story, or did he do anything that is of value when we look at kind of navigating the shoals of the Middle East today?
Right. Well, you know, the kind of sad story of American foreign policy generally is how presidents can get so distracted and invested in a particular crises of the times or issues of the times that the rest of the world really doesn't get the attention it needs, and which may have long-term effects. And you can look at right now at what's happening with ISIS and Obama and the Middle East, and begin to think about all the other problems that need addressing in Latin America and elsewhere that just simply aren't getting attention. And that's what happened during the Reagan period. The Reagan period was focused on Nicaragua, Central America, and it was focused on what at first was seen as the evil empire, the Soviet Union, and this tremendous buildup that Reagan initiated to fight the Cold War. And then Reykjavik, where he sort of turned and really paved the way for some kind of reconciliation between the Soviet Union, Gorbachev, and himself. And the Middle East got really very little attention. It came in, just as you said, in the Iran-Contra affair. But really, Reagan was much more interested in the Contras than in Iran. And it wasn't even Reagan, really. It was Hayes, the Secretary of State at the time. What's interesting is that at the very end, the last year of the administration, the second Reagan administration, Secretary of State Shultz began to put some attention to the Middle East and to the notion of putting some pressure on Israel to recognize and deal with the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. It was the time when Arafat was coming to slowly moving towards the conclusion that there would be a two-state solution rather than the Palestinians hoping to eliminate Israel altogether. When they eventually, soon after Reagan got out of office, they declared a Palestinian state. So it was only then, and I don't think there were too many lessons to be drawn from that. I think the real action came after Reagan with the first Bush presidency, George H.M. Bush.
Yeah, and that's a good segue, actually. You devote a lot of attention in your book to the Gulf War, or the first Gulf War, that is. Would you like to say more about that and why you think that's such an important moment in the Middle East?
Sure. Well, I mentioned earlier how the United States had forged this strategic partnership with Israel, and that first Gulf War in 1990-1991 spelled the end of that relationship. The United States at that time really felt that it could put together a working coalition to counter Iraq and Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, and it did put together this 30-plus countries, and I think that American foreign policymakers also saw this as the basis for a long-term role of the United States in a post-Cold War world, that it could put together this broad coalition of the United States at the helm to prevent the kind of aggression anywhere, outside the Middle East as well, that the kind of aggression that Saddam Hussein had undertaken. And to put together that coalition, they felt they had to give the cold shoulder to Israel, that Saudi Arabia and Turkey and maybe not Turkey so much, but Morocco and Egypt and others would be very reluctant. Syria was even in that coalition, to participate. In fact, wouldn't participate in a coalition that included Israel. And so the strategic relationship with Israel unraveled. It doesn't mean that Israel sort of went off the charts. There still was a lot of cooperation between the militaries of Israel and the United States and intelligence, but the kind of strategic relationship that existed from 1970 to 1990 unraveled, and the United States really saw this new path towards foreign policy with this broad coalition, no other superpower around, the United States at the helm.
It's an interesting argument in light of, you address it in your book in several places, the John Mersheimer and Stephen Walt thesis about the power of the Israeli lobby and kind of, for lack of a better term, messing up U.S. foreign policy and diverting the United States from its natural interests. And I'm putting those in quotes here. I'd wondered if you'd just say a few words about what your evaluation of that thesis is in that very controversial book.
Right. Well, no one can deny that AIPAC, the lobby for Israel in the United States, is powerful. It is powerful, and there was just another article about it in the New Yorker a couple of weeks ago, which reinforced that point. On this is a seriously powerful lobby, probably second only to the National Rifle Association. But I think that Walt and Mersheimer sort of get it wrong when they try to understand the distortion of American foreign policy through the power of AIPAC. Yes, AIPAC had a lot of power, particularly in Congress, and often made it difficult for any president to kind of take on Israel because of the social capital that he would lose by opposing Israel. But it seems to me that that thesis is way overstated, that American interests, as the United States understood them, and as I kind of read through all these protocols and all the history of American foreign relations in the last 65 years, it's very hard to see AIPAC playing more than an auxiliary role here. And I don't think they read through those protocols. I don't think they read that history very well. And I think they just sort of slapped that thesis onto on far too easily.
Well, I like how you addressed it in your book. You were direct and to the point, and you know, I think in many ways blew it out of the water. What I liked about it, and I'm not a specialist on the Middle East like you are, but a lot of people dismissed it, and I don't even think they ever read the book. They just immediately said it's anti-Semitic, it's terrible, and I don't think they ever really grappled with it other than just passing it off as anti-Semitism. So I appreciate that in the book, that you took it as an intellectually serious argument, and I think, you know, showed the holes in it.
Well, they're intellectually serious guys. they're two of the main international relations specialists. So I think you have to take it seriously. But I think they had also, if I can just say a word more on it, and I say this in the book, these two figures are what political scientists call realists, which believe that that national interests come from a variety of the factors that have to do with population size and geographic placement of the country, of its military strength, of its economic strength, and so on. And here they just sort of saw all what any realist would see as the national interests of the United States as distorted by this one lobby, which seemed not to make sense in their own terms.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to come back to the issue of polyscience in the Middle East in a bit, but I was wondering if you could say something about the U.S. relationship with Iran since 1979 and the Islamic Revolution. You devote a lot of attention in the book to Iran and its ups and downs as far as its regional influence since the revolution. So I was wondering if you could say something about that.
Well, you know, the relationship with Iran has been, I think, the centerpiece of the American place in the Middle East, but also Iran has been the most important and powerful country, the United States notwithstanding, in the region for the last 30 years. So what is it that the United States finds so disturbing about Iran? And I think the answer lies in that Iran has a very, very different understanding of the way governments and states should be organized. The United States had this notion of secular governments, of democracy, of sometimes supporting dictators as well. Here, but all of these were seen to be status quo or stable conservative forces that would rule their own peoples and not cause tremendous trouble outside. Iran really had a radical vision for the Middle East, and this was new Islamic republics in which Islam would be the centerpiece of politics, and that this was a revisionist vision that they had the responsibility to sort of not only rule their own people this way, but to bring this sort of rule to others, and particularly to other Muslims throughout the region. And so here you had a status quo power like the United States facing off against a revisionist power that wanted to change the entire region. And what Iran did was create a set of allies that created what I call a northern tier, that is from the Persian Gulf. You had Iran and then Syria to the west, and then to the west of that, Hezbollah in Lebanon, all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. And this, I think, posed some serious geostrategic challenges to the United States, those were the defining issues of the relationship.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the term status quo. You make the argument in the book that the American government stuck with, I guess is a better way of putting it, with a lot of these Middle East, authoritarian rulers that ruled for, it depended, whether it's Libya or other places, Egypt, the Mubarak regime, for far too long, and it didn't really help its interests by sticking with the status quo. At the same time, you have a government, the George W. Bush administration, that purposely comes in to kind of break the logjam of the status quo in its own unique way, and also causes nothing but trouble for American foreign policy. I was wondering if you could say a few words about your evaluation of the second war in Iraq and the policies of the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah. So the United States, through the second half of the 20th century, the half century between the end of World War II and the end of the century, basically defined for almost all that period, except for the last 10 years, defined American foreign policy in terms of the Cold War. And so everywhere, they were supporting status quo governments as long as they were anti-communist. And this meant Noriega in Panama and in the Philippines and you could name it anywhere. And the Middle East was no exception. Where they could find stable rulers who were willing to line up against the Soviets, they were willing to abide them. Now, the last 10 years of the 20th century, the people began to rethink this. First of all, the Cold War was over. There was no Soviet Union. What was American foreign policy going to be? And George W. Bush really began to see a different set of threats to the United States. And that meant a kind of now revisionist policy by the United States to forestall these threats And what we called this was regime change. We were going to knock out certain people, namely Saddam Hussein, in order to bring about the kind of order that we wanted. So this was a truly imperialist policy in the sense that it really brought the United States into the world in a much different fashion from before, in which it really was trying to shape what the world would look like.
You use the term reverse domino theory. I thought that was very interesting how you worded that, and it seemed to be my mind you were actually articulating better than the Bush administration failed to do it many times. And people, especially the president, when they asked him what he was trying to do, and he included the Iraq war and the war on terror, that seems to be, I think, what he had in mind. Would you like to say something more about the reverse domino theory?
Right. Well, the original domino theory comes from Southeast Asia, where, as many people will remember, the United States feared that the fall of Vietnam would create a domino effect, and other countries, Cambodia, Thailand, Laos, Indonesia, Malaysia, would all fall to communism. So this was called the domino theory. So we had to stop that first domino from falling so that we would not have all the other regimes fall as well. The reverse domino theory was that if we could initiate that first domino falling, and this means bad regimes, rogue regimes, regimes that are tied in with terrorists, that are producing weapons of mass destruction, that are creating instability and security threats to the United States, if we could push the first one over, that being Iraq, then all the others would fall and the United States wouldn't even have to do very much. It wouldn't have to throw out each dictator separately. It wouldn't have to undo each terrorist network individually. And so the hope was that if you demonstrate that the United States is resolved to change the world, that others like Gaddafi in Libya, Assad in Syria, the dictators in Central Asia would fall quickly, their programs for weapons of mass destruction would be undone, the terrorist networks would fall apart. And that was the reverse domino theory.
I mean, you developed this in the book in some length, and I thought it was fascinating why they had so much faith in this idea of reverse domino theory, even though they understood the region, to be frank, poorly. In my mind, it raises the issues of kind of dealing in models rather than deep history and understanding, I hate to use this phrase, but the facts on the ground rather than in the laboratory of the world of models. And the totalitarian regimes were weak at their core, like, say, Czechoslovakia, that they would just topple. At the end of the day, I guess I'd like you to say a little bit more about that, how they reached these conclusions in their minds that it would be, you know, it would be toppling these regimes would be fairly easy once you whacked Iraq.
Right. I think there are two points to be made in response to your question, Christian. Number one is that these ideas were developed even before Bush came into power in the 1990s by brilliant neoconservative thinkers who were almost exclusively big picture people who had very little understanding of the particular region and the Middle East especially. So they had these broad theories of how the world would work. They were kind of mechanistic theories, and with not the kind of understanding that you would hope for about the nitty-gritty of day-to-day life in particular places. That's the first issue. The second issue is that every president from Roosevelt on who saw the United States as being a world power, being everywhere all the time, night and day in every nook and cranny in the world, had to find a way to limit the United States' expenses, the resources it would put out, for fear that it would, in Dwight Eisenhower's words, go bankrupt if it tried to do everything everywhere. Now, other presidents before George W. Bush all had the same idea, that cookie-cutter model that I referred to earlier, which was, we'll find strategic partners in each region of the world, and they will bear some of the costs, and they will take the lead, and we'll sort of back them up, and we don't have to do everything everywhere, even though we're the world's greatest power. George W. Bush's idea, these thinkers' idea, was the way we're going to limit resources is we will don't have to topple every dictator. We don't have to root out every terrorist network. Or we just have to set the dominoes in motion. And once we do that, expend the money in Iraq, the other places will fall into line. And so it was a way in their minds of having the United States adopt a policy that wouldn't bankrupt it.
Interesting. To switch gears slightly, one of the chapters in your book deals with the rise of non-state actors in the Middle East over the course of the past two, well, more so, I guess, since the 70s, and well, and in the case of the PLO into the 60s. I was wondering if you would tell us a little bit about where those fit into the picture of the modern Middle East, these non-state actors like Hezbollah, for example.
Right. I have to say that section was kind of prescient because while when I wrote the book, there were certainly non-state actors like Hezbollah and Hamas that were important actors, what we have in the period since the book was written in the last 2 years was a proliferation of these actors like ISIS and others, which all of a sudden have come to prominence in a way that even I didn't imagine when I wrote the book. So the first real serious non-state actor to play a role in the Middle East was the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and it was very important, and I think a model for some of the things that happened subsequently. And these other actors rose as states began to weaken. There was a moment in the 1950s and early 1960s when there was this belief that the new states of the Middle East would become powerful actors, centralized, purposive, coherent, cohesive, and that didn't happen. What we're seeing now in the disintegration of Yemen, Libya, Iraq, Syria, the just pure disintegration of these countries is a process that was already evident in the 1970s, that the cohesiveness and coherence and ability to centralize power just didn't materialize. It's within those kind of crevices that the state opened up where it didn't govern, basically, that these new non-state actors began to play an important role. If I can say just a word on ISIS now, ISIS is, on the one hand, extraordinarily scary. I mean, anybody who's seen these videos and the beheadings and everything else has to be deeply alarmed. The way they routed the Iraqi army has to be quite alarmed. At the same time, I think they have been overrated. Their rule now comes in areas that basically had no government before. It wasn't like they pushed out the state in most of the places that they're ruling now in Syria and Iraq. There was no state. There was no government. There was nothing. There was nothing but chaos in these places, or local leadership. And so, I think it would be much more difficult. And I don't expect to see it for ISIS to actually take over and govern a state. And so many of these non-state actors pushed into these areas that were ungoverned by states. and were able to emerge in that way.
It's an interesting point. And I guess in my mind, it raises the question of what I think the American public and American politicians don't always think about enough, is the changes in the Middle East that have taken place in the last 30 years. You and other scholars have made the argument that the population of today in the Middle East is, you know, significantly different in terms of the age, the access to technology, the aspirations in terms of government. I mean, the fact that these countries have very few well-paying jobs for young people who, you know, even have gotten modern education, if you want to use that term. I guess, you know, when you have the government breaking down and all these questions, I mean, it raises the issue of how, you know, events are going to go in the Middle East in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years. So I guess on that note, what advice do you have for our current President Obama about how to, you know, conduct U.S. policy, or just general advice for Americans, you know, dealing with the Middle East in light of all the changes that are taking place and all the obvious problems with bad governance in groups like ISIS? How would you advise people to be?
Well, let me say a couple of things. First of all, American foreign policy tends to be a bit like a pendulum, and it goes too far in either direction. In the 2000s, we were far too interventionist, far too much to the point that we could change this whole area, that we could shape it to our liking. This wasn't going to happen. And then in the first Obama administration, we have this withdrawal, and alarming to some of the United States' friends, that how much the United States seemed to be turning its back on the region. And then now we have yet again, you know, the United States involved and probably over-involved. The pendulum keeps swinging, and I would argue that the United States has to recognize this is a region in deep, deep trouble. It is one where the convulsions that are occurring now have no clear end. That the United States has strong interests in the region to keep the shipping lanes open, to make sure that the regimes that are friendly to the United States and that the peoples that are friendly to the United States can operate without threat to them. There are many, many interests that the United States continues to have in the region, but that it can't shape this region and it can't solve all these problems. It cannot stop the convulsions. What it can do is to ally with others and help to manage the crises as best as possible. And therefore, it seems to me not... I think I make the point somewhere in the book that we always, when we have a problem, instead of seeing them as crises to be managed, we see them as wars. The war on drugs, the war on terror. And these become outsized responses. And I think that the United States has to be very careful now not to have an outsized response and not to swing too far to the other side of not being involved at all.
Just to find that happy medium as far as policy.
That's right. Okay. Think about foreign policy in terms of crisis management rather than reshaping regions, states, and the like.
Interesting. So, I mean, at the end of the day, you have a chapter on the Obama administration, and you said a few words about it, but is it just, you know, is you think there's anything that he can, his administration can accomplish that would be of real value before his term is over, or is it more, you know, just do the best you can, deal with the fires until someone can, until the next election and someone is elected who can come in with a fresh start, if you want to use that term?
Yeah, well, it's going to be very hard to have major achievements now. In the book, I suggest that the United States get behind, in a serious way, get behind the Arab Peace Initiative, which was a plan floated in 2002 and still very, very much on the table, that would have allied Israel, the United States, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and some of the Persian Gulf states, Jordan, put them into a coalition that would try to minimize the forces arrayed against them in the Middle East. It depended upon the United States helping and urging Israel to solve the Palestinian problems, again, because it's hard to build a coalition with Israel as long as you have Arab states and the Palestinian problem still exists. They tried to solve the Palestinian issue, and it didn't work. And I don't think with the current leadership in Israel it can work. But I do think that is the direction that the Obama administration has to take. It has to be looking to create coalitions backing up the peoples and regimes and urging them to move forward on democracy and other issues without having the illusion that it can shape them and get them to do everything it wants.
Interesting. Do you think that the U.S. relationship with Turkey will improve significantly in the coming years, or will it stay, relatively, it seems to have some tensions, obviously, but where do you think that relationship will evolve?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's certainly not going to return to what it was in the 1950s and 60s, 70s and 80s, when Turkey was a steadfast, I think it'd be a member, but a steadfast member of NATO, and its attention was really turned towards the Soviet Union and helping the United States in the Cold War. For a variety of reasons, Turkey has become a much more independent actor, and an independent actor means sometimes you're going to like what they do and sometimes you're not going to like what they do. And they've moved also to much more engagement with the Middle East. I think the United States and Turkey still have a lot of common interests. Certainly, the ISIS and the various other non-state actors who are really posing serious problems on Turkey's border, including a huge refugee problem. I think Turkey more and more is going to see itself lining up with the United States on this issue. At first, it thought, well, these terrorist groups like ISIS are Sunni Muslims, and we're Sunni Muslims, therefore we can find common cause with them. I think that's going to evaporate very quickly. And so I think also Turkey will begin to move back to some kind of accommodation with Israel, which is also a policy that the United States has been pushing. So I do think, and there are many commercial interests and economic interests that they share. So I do think that the United States and Turkey are going to have some move closer in the next year or so. But I don't think it's going to be dramatic.
Okay. I mean, it would seem to me that Turkey would have to play a role in any sort of Palestinian settlement and regional settlement. It seems like a country that's in a unique position, like you said, being a Sunni country that, is experiencing some economic growth and has, maybe not the, most open government at times, but certainly a competent government and a government that functions far better than, a lot of governments in the Middle East.
The problem for Turkey is, and so it's a little hard to predict right now, is that its basic foreign policy that it had nurtured for the last 10 years has fallen apart. That policy gave a name to that policy, which was called zero problems with neighbors, and it meant that they had a reconciliation with Syria. They were developing closer relations with Iran. They were moving towards better relations with Egypt. Their relations with Israel were good. This is all up through about 2009. And so they really saw themselves as facilitators. They were going to be the mediators between the United States and Iran. They were going to facilitate talks between the Fatah of the PLO and Hamas. They were going to be brokers between Israel and the Palestinians, and so on and so forth. All that has fallen apart. Not only do they not have zero problems with neighbors, they have multiple problems on every border with neighbors. Their relationship with Israel has fallen apart. With Syria, they were among the first to jump on the bandwagon against Bashar al-Assad. Their relations with Egypt have fallen apart altogether. So the question now is, what are they going to do? If everything's fallen apart, what is their new policy going to be? And I don't think they know yet. And so we just have to watch this carefully.
Yes, I agree. No, I'm taking a lot of your time, but I have one more question I'd like to ask. I could probably ask 20 more, but I certainly want to get in one more before we run out of time. In my U.S. foreign policy classes, I devote a fair amount of attention to the Fukuyama and Huntington articles about the class of civilization and the end of history. And I'm interested what your take is, and I can sort of guess what you would argue, but it seems a lot of, at least among the general public, really kind of see Huntington's argument as having a lot of explanatory power about the recent impasse and kind of the way the world has grown so turbulent since the end of the Cold War. And based on your expertise, what would you say, how would you evaluate Huntington's arguments, that he made in the early 1990s, moving ahead to 2014?
Yeah, so first I should say, as a public disclosure, Samuel Huntington was my dissertation advisor, and we had a close relationship. He was very helpful to me in my career. I don't buy his argument on the clash of civilizations, and I think it actually has done more harm than good. He wrote this, in the 1990s, and Fukuyama about the same time, when they were looking towards the end of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, trying to figure out what the world would look like in the future. I think what the argument misses is how heterogeneous and complex these areas are, these so-called civilizations are, particularly the Muslim civilization that he labels. I have students from this region who, are so dead set against some of the trends that they see in their country and some of the groups. There are many, many forces at work here. To give them a kind of overall, an overarching framework of calling them Islamic civilization really doesn't do justice to the complexity of what we're seeing there. And I think this is a lesson for American foreign policy. There are allies for us to make in this region, and there are those who see our principles of equality for women, of human rights, and of others as just as relevant to their region as they are to the United States. And I think that was missed in that argument.
Yeah, that's a fair point, I think. Both the articles in their own, the Fukuyama and Huntington, have their certainly their blind spots. So I'm sorry for taking up so much of your time. The interview's, we've gone over an hour now, and I have one final question. I was wondering what future plans you have, what your projects you might be working on or envision yourself doing in the next couple years.
Well, actually, I'm turning to a question that was raised in my mind and is probably even more sharp now than it was when it was raised in my mind years ago. When I would, you know, did research in India and in the Middle East, I would see, you know, various groups, you know, just to give a quick anecdote, I would see a guy from the countryside come into the city and go up to a kiosk and try to buy a sandwich. And this is an actual thing that I witnessed. And the fellow says, "I'd like to order a sandwich." And the kiosk owner says, "Sure, what kind of sandwich would you like?" And he thinks to himself, he said, I was waiting in line behind him. He said, I can't tell you what kind of sandwich. You have to tell me." And the store owner said, No, you're the customer. You tell." And so what you saw was this, the lack of a kind of common set of rules for how to interact day by day. And that's a very trivial example that I'm giving. But what I'm trying to get at is, when does a public form where people have an understanding of problems, not that they agree on the problem, but they have a common understanding of what the problem is, of what the rules of interaction are, of how you treat someone else. And it seems to me that that's key to democracy. I'm actually going to look at this over a long span from in the United States, from the middle of the 19th century, when we started to urbanize and we created what I call a society of strangers, where you were constantly interacting with people you never saw before in your life and may never see again in your life every day. How did the rules of that interaction form? How did they disadvantage some people, benefit others? How were they changed? And what relationship did that have to the creation of a working democracy? So that's my project for the future.
Wow, that's quite a turn and a very interesting idea. It's funny you mentioned that. I just was putting together, for a wide variety of reasons, readings on de Tocqueville for school. And I was going back and reading some of his observations on democracy. And it seems to me that, I mean, those are very interesting questions, and the questions that he poses in his observation, in my mind, are just as relevant today as they were back in the 1840s. I mean, the question of how people interact and the norms and the civil society that he pays so much attention to, it's all really thought-provoking, interesting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, far be it from me here to even feel I'm in the same category as Tocqueville, but I really want to extend some of his kinds of observations of how a society coheres and when, but with also with the idea that whenever that happens, there are underlying rules, and rules always disadvantage some people and cause tension. So I want to look at that, you know, in 2014 instead of when he did in the 19th century.
And yes, it's interesting, and it's, you know, I don't mean to keep you on the line, but the role of social media today. I had a student in class who wanted to. She wanted to organize a protest against Big Rapids policy, and all she really did to kind of get people to protest was write it on her Facebook page, and she couldn't figure out why people weren't kind of joining up with her to go protest this policy. And it's my mind, it would be like, you got to go out there, you got to recruit, you got to go door to door, you got to do the nuts and bolts of that type of stuff. So
right, that's true.
Yeah. So well, thank you for your time, Joel. It was I enjoyed reading Shifting Sands. I think it's a book that will be beneficial for American policymakers, general public, and pretty much, you know, everyone all over the world to read. And it was a joy to talk to you today.
Thank you, Christian. It was a pleasure for me too.
Thank you for listening to New Books in World Affairs. We hope you join us again in the very near future. Take care.